Remember, Sally, when I promised to kill you last?
That's right, Major. You did.
I lied.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Next Lander Watchcast. This will be our last Watchcast for a couple of weeks, as Benny is out, and then we're all going to be out next week. But we wanted to make sure we got one more in here under the wire before Brad and I take off. Brad Shoemaker,
hello, how are you doing? Hi, I'm doing well.
Fantastic. And since Vinny's not here, we needed a third chair. We needed an expert. We needed a film student, a student of cinema, to come here and talk about today's film, Daniel Reichert.
Hello, Alex Navarro and Brad Shoemaker. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, Academic Dan?
Well, as an academic, I was doing very well before, but then just before the recording started here, I started feeling better because I heard that one Mr. Shoemaker had not seen this film before, which I don't know how I didn't learn this in my years working with you and scream at you until you watched it. Hell, me and Drew watched it in the other room probably while you were there. I would have
probably
dragged you on
several times, in fact.
Yeah. We've done like several film reporties, I think, of it.
Life has changed, I have to say.
Yeah.
Okay. This is not even like commentary on whether I liked the movie or not, but I'm trying to think how to put the... Where has this movie been my whole life? I guess what I mean by that is like this feels like a fundamental piece of American pop culture from the 80s.
Oh, absolutely. My God.
Like, okay, we're off to a good start.
This feels like a load-bearing piece of pop culture. It's
just like it is.
Like a lot of things make a little more sense now that I've seen this.
Before we get really into that aspect, let's just actually say what the movie is, because we haven't said it yet. It is the 1985 Schwarzenegger action classic, Commando, a film that I know, Dan, you are very familiar with. I am also very familiar with. But yes, once I realized, one, Brad had never seen it, and two, it totally fit in with our loose theme of people who were in the Twin Peaks cast. Why not do this? So let's do it. And here we are, Commando.
Well, Brad, I can see how this happened with you, how you didn't see it, because I grew up loving Schwarzenegger. I mean, Terminator, Predator, all that stuff. I loved that shit. I mean, I've seen Junior and Kindergarten Cop and even the Dumb Ones a million times as a kid. And I had avoided this. I was not aware of this until I was in college. I was like 2 or 3 years into college. Huh. And we went to Hastings, a used DVD store. And we're just, me and a friend, we're just going through the aisles. And all of a sudden I see this, Commando. I may have seen the poster at some point before, but I really didn't know anything about it. And it wasn't until I flipped it over and they just had the shot of him with that giant bazooka on the back.
Yes.
And I was like, all right,
that's it.
I'm buying this. We're watching this tonight. And I went back and we watched it, and the whole time, I mean, he hadn't seen it either. We're just like freaking out. Just every one liner, every death. Like, how are people not talking about this alongside every great action movie and Schwarzenegger movie? It seems like the Schwarzenegger movie in terms of like all of the, the one liners, the dumb action, all that stuff. It's not the best Schwarzenegger movie. But it's the
most. But it hits every touchstone.
Yeah, it's like the most Arnold movie.
And it's the most perhaps unhinged of any of his movies I've ever
it's
seen.
It's way up there.
This movie is absolutely batshit.
Yeah.
It's completely batshit. And the thing is, I think it is nowhere near like the best movie Arnold has ever been in, but it is maybe the most distilled Arnold persona put into a single film, which is amazing because this is really the first one of these in his career.
Like, that's the thing. I felt like so many more things made sense as I was watching this, like 18 different like NES box covers.
Or like McBain, Simpsons.
Right, McBain, but like, and maybe we should get to this in context as we talk through the movie, but like Schwarzenegger and like largely this movie kind of like started the whole muscle-bound action hero thing that people are still like decrying today. You know what I mean? Like you see people out there constantly going like, man, it really fucking sucks that just to be in an action movie these days, you have to be on like human growth hormone and steroids and like be jacked like 5 times bigger than you should be. You know what I mean? Like this kind of like unrealistic standard for physical fitness. And it's all because we have this action, like this bodybuilder turned action star, right? As
opposed to what movies in that vein predated like big, I'm sure there are some examples of like a muscly dude that kills a bunch of people, but like famous, movie in this vein happened before Commando?
Well, so here's the thing is that like Schwarzenegger's career up to this point, the big touchstones are the two Conan movies and the first Terminator. Those are the ones that came before this. This was the thing he did immediately after Terminator.
Yeah.
Stallone was out there doing some of this stuff, but even like the first Rambo is not this at all.
No,
like it is very
Rambo's
much
not the
it's
first
a
Terminator's
drama.
Yeah, it's a character study. You know, like it's
with
when
some
was
action
Rambo 2, First Blood Part 2.
But
when
this
was that?
Is the same year as Rambo 2. 1985 is this weird turning point where I think between Commando and Rambo 2 coming out around the same time, basically those are the load-bearing, like, you know, beams that hold up the muscle-bound action genre that came immediately after the fact.
Yeah, like, I really felt like I was witnessing something kind of prototypical as I was watching this. It was just like, so much has flowed from this movie.
It feels like parody, but you think that, like, when it came out, it's, you know, it wasn't, if there wasn't a lot like that.
I mean, I think when this came out, everyone knew it was a hoot and holler movie, and it was not anything to be taken that seriously, but as a hoot and holler movie, it is kind of perfect, because it never slows down. Something dumber manages to happen every 5 minutes, and the one-liners are just constant to the degree that even apparently in the debut of the film and its opening night, people were still yelling out lines from the trailer during opening night.
Imagine being in college when this came out and just getting some friends together, sneaking a six-pack into the theater. That would have been a delight.
Amazing. Like,
this movie is legitimately hilarious.
It truly is.
Like, I was like dying laughing at numerous points.
And also, his daughter is like kidnapped by like a group of like rogue commandos, and he's just given one-liners every time he murders someone.
Yeah, like, it's like every once in a while they sort of touch on this idea that he was doing this awful like black ops wet work shit, and then he's like, you know, he's not doing that anymore. He doesn't want to be violent. But every time he comes time to kill people, it's like he has these things queued up ready to go every time he kills a guy.
I had not seen the director's cut until I'd watched it for this, and there are a couple scenes. There's not much difference.
It's very little different.
Yeah, it's like there's the one where he's in the car with the woman that he kidnapped, and there's a little bit of like, oh, so what did he do? And he's like, oh, you know, didn't get to see my kids growing up. I was doing, you know, jobs in Angola and this place. And, oh, what do you do? He's like, oh, things I you don't want to know about, things I wish I didn't know about. And like, that's the first time I had seen that. Normally, I'd seen the one where he is just straight up robotic, wisecracking murder man. You know, it's like, it's funny that they saw that in the director's cut. They're like, we don't need that. Take out that character development. Out. Yeah.
They're infrequent, but there are a handful of points in this where his like kind of general demeanor and bearing is basically that of the Terminator.
not far off.
Like literally not even emoting, just emotionlessly.
Yeah. Are you going to tell me what's going on? No.
No.
Like,
no. What do you mean? No.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, you know, Commando, like, it's not a movie I'm ever going to call good in the sense that it is not particularly well plotted. None of these characters make a lot of sense. Very little of what is happening makes much sense, but that doesn't matter because you're here for the ride. That's what this movie is. It is basically a theme park ride of dudes dying in increasingly spectacular ways with occasional moments of Ray Don Chong dialogue. And the main thing with her and sort of like the stuff that they add into the director's cut, which is like 90 seconds of extra footage. Like, I think there's like two slightly more violent cuts of stuff from the ending. Brad, we watched the director's cut as well, so you didn't miss anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the dialogue stuff you mentioned. It's not a director's cut. It's literally just the last bit of shit they had lying around on the cutting room floor. But none of that stuff matters, and none of it's good, but also it's so infrequent and so inconsequential to what's actually happening that who cares?
It's like Alyssa Milano saying, my dad's going to kick your ass instead of my dad's going to, you know, beat your head in or something.
Yeah.
It's nothing.
It went from R-rated to slightly more R-rated. You know, like, it's not that much of a difference.
Also no. Like, this, like, quote-unquote director's cut barely clears 90 minutes. So, like, I can't even imagine how, like, short and focused and nonstop the non-director's cut must be.
It's a very Rocky IV situation where it's like every time I watch either Commando or Rocky IV, I have that moment where it's like, oh shit, we're already at the fight, or oh shit, we're already at the island. Like, it's just like, okay, well, because like the last fight, the Drago fight, and also the assault on the island are like the last half hour of these already short movies. So it feels like you get to the end very quickly.
Once they get to the island, like, it is just, you are on a downhill slope of dudes exploding. Like, that is really all it is.
And a lighthouse exploding four times.
Yep. So, I'll just say for my part, I don't remember exactly when I saw this movie, though I think it was definitely later in my perusing of Schwarzenegger stuff. Like, I was probably, I don't know, 13, 14 years old or something, finally. I saw it on HBO or something someday. I had already seen like Predator and most of the Terminator stuff at that point, and you know, some of his other. I think I'd even seen like Red Heat before I saw Commando. But yeah, I think Brad, for me, what this movie is kind of a Rosetta Stone for a lot of the, like you said, video game references, things in pop culture that are just like this, whether or not they are specifically referencing Commando or just things that are like Commando. Commando is an incredibly oft-referenced thing throughout action cinema and things like it.
Yeah, and it's like it's multiple elements together, you know, because like when I said earlier, like, oh, you know, this kind of started the muscle-bound action hero, like, you know, you said, like, the Conan movies existed existed before this, right? Like, it's not like this is Arnold's first outing or anything, but it's specifically the incredibly jacked, muscle-bound dude, the fatigues, like, camouflage, the extremely heavy military weaponry. Like, all those things together, you know, are, like, such an archetype for so many things after this.
Yeah.
And even, like, Conan, like, I know that predates this, but I saw that for the first time a couple years ago, and, like, that's a very different movie. Yeah, he's jacked, and he kills some guys and stuff in it, but, like, it seemed like it was trying for something other than this, like, you
it's
know.
A dark fantasy epic. It's not doing this kind of bombast at all.
Right, right.
Yeah. So, there isn't, like, a real long storied history to this movie or anything, but I will get into a little of what we have here. But before I do that, just very briefly, Vinnie Caravella has seen this movie. He did give me a few bullet points that he wanted me to express during the course of our conversation, which I will. And I do have his ranking for the end of this podcast, where he puts it on his big list. So, I will tell everyone that when we get there. But as far as the history goes, so this is written by three different screenwriters, two of which wrote the original script. That is Jeff Loeb and Matthew Wiseman, who were writing partners back in the 80s. Loeb went on to be the head of Marvel Television for several years when they were making stuff like Punisher and Iron Fist. But he eventually left Marvel around the time they kind of consolidated everything under Kevin Feige. But so his original script was more of a straight-up kidnapping thriller. It was not an action movie for the most part. And it starred, it was supposed to set, an Israeli commando who has given up the wartime life and is now dealing with, you know, people kidnapping his daughter. And the original person that they wrote that script in mind with was Gene Simmons.
Oh, no.
Huh.
And Gene Simmons turned it down.
He was above Commando? Gene Simmons was?
And if you go look up Gene Simmons' acting career, let me tell you, Tim turning anything down is kind of shocking.
I was going to say, I don't even know, like, what has he been in?
He was in a few 80s things. Like, there was this one really fucking god-awful, like, John Stamos movie, I think, that he is, like, the villain in. But he's not a good actor, is the thing. Gene Simmons is not a very good actor. He's barely a good bass player.
He's not good at many things, from what I've seen.
He can do the tongue thing. He's got that going.
Yeah, it's great.
But so by the time our director, Mark L. Lester, signed on, those guys were out of the picture, and Stephen D'Souza had already been brought in to rewrite the script and turn it into something else entirely. And if you know D'Souza, you know him because he wrote Die Hard and 48 Hours and wrote and directed Street Fighter.
Now, Alex, you can maybe clear this up for me. Uh-huh. I'd always heard the rumor or whatever that either Die Hard was supposed to be Commando 2, or it would have been Die Hard was supposed to be Commando 2, right? Was it like written to be a John Matrix thing, and then they just shifted around because Schwarzenegger did Predator or something?
So I believe that story is apocryphal. It is not actually the case that at any point this was supposed to be a Commando sequel, because D'Souza is not the original writer of the Die Hard screenplay. He's a guy who came in and did rewrites. But I also completely understand how that story would get passed around, because this sure does feel like a thing that John Matrix totally could have starred in.
I mean, you could see it. It's a similar, like, one-man army thing. John Matrix becomes John McClane.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
So, once Lester came on, they had already started rewriting the script, and apparently D'Souza did his work very quickly. I listened to the Mark Lester commentary, which is very funny, because he basically sounds like me when I'm trying to do a nerd voice, and it's just him talking about, like, oh, yeah, Arnold's killing these guys. It's great. We loved it. All these these extras were just running around, and they were just shooting each other with blanks. I kept trying to get them to stop, but they wouldn't. You know, like, it's just this incredible, like, macho bombast thing going on. It's like, oh, yeah, no, when he blew up those stuntmen, we thought that was really cool. And so D'Souza did his work in about 6 days, it sounds like, all his rewrites and kind of redoing the whole thing. And Lester, if you know him from anything, he directed Firestarter, the Stephen King adaptation.
Oh, is that the, that's the Drew Barrymore one, right?
Yes, the Drew Barrymore one, which is not great, but has some moments, including George C. Scott pretending to be Native American.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Firestorm was Howie Long. Right?
Yeah, Davis Firestorm, very different movie.
Okay, great, great.
Lester also directed films like Roller Boogie, the disco musical, and the other Brandon Lee movie, Showdown in Little Tokyo.
Oh, with Dolph Lundgren. I've seen
with
that.
Dolph Lundgren,
yeah.
Yes. Not a great movie, but okay.
Not
functional.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that is Lester's directorial style. Workmanlike, functional, not particularly creative, but you get the right people with him, maybe he can turn in something good.
In the right era, it seemed like he was working in the right era for his skills, I think.
Absolutely. So let's talk about our cast here for a second. Schwarzenegger, we mentioned, this is kind of, he's getting to top of the box office status. He's not all the way there yet, but he, you know, the first Terminator had just come out the year prior to this. This is kind of his first big modern starring action vehicle. Radon Chong, daughter of Tommy Chong. Yes.
I did not know that.
Also did not know that until I looked it up.
Yep.
I only know her from this movie. Oh, wow.
This is one of six movies she appeared in just 1985.
What the hell?
Like, why do
what
I know
she
her name? Like, I knew her name coming to, I don't think I've ever seen anything that she's in, but I knew her name before I watched this, and I'm not entirely sure why.
It's because between 1984 and 1985, she was in like 11 movies for some reason. And I don't really know why, because I'm going to be honest with you. She's fine in this. She plays a good foil who doesn't understand anything that's happening, but she is not a great actress.
This seemed like the right role for her.
Yeah.
She's
totally competent in for what this movie is calling for.
It is not demanding a great deal of her other than to be very freaked out a lot.
She scouted Chris Pratt when he was 19.
I read that on her Wikipedia
at
page
Bubba
last
Gump.
Night. Yep.
Bubba Gump Shrimp Company. On her Wikipedia.
Radon Chong. The world owes Radon Chong for Chris Pratt.
So we don't have Chris Pratt Mario without Radon Chong going to a Bubba Gump Shrimp Company.
And also maybe not if she's not in Commando, maybe she doesn't have that kind of pull to even scout someone like Chris Pratt.
Right.
So basically Chris Pratt is Commando's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah.
That's how we're drawing it back here. Alyssa Milano is here as Jenny, the daughter. This is her second movie ever.
Yeah, I did not recognize her at first.
I think I am, like a lot of people, was introduced to Alyssa Milano on Who's the Boss. That is what I knew Alyssa Milano to be when I was growing up.
Yeah, was that after this?
That was not long after this.
Okay.
I haven't seen her in a lot of stuff. Like, she wasn't in that Lost in Space remake. That was Lacey Chabert, right?
Yes. That was Lacey Chabert. I want to say that Alyssa Milano was mostly doing a lot of direct-to-video work in the 90s.
Okay.
Of the occasionally softcore variety.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I remember that being the thing when, what was it, like Charmed was the thing that kind of brought her back into the mainstream?
Yes, that was the thing that really kind of got her back into the mainstream consciousness.
Right.
Vernon Wells is Bennett, our extremely Australian and homoerotic villain. He got this role very much on the strength of his previous performance, which was in The Road Warrior.
He's good in that.
He's very good in that.
Mohawk, yeah.
He's ridiculous here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was always confused by his weird, like, Scott Steiner chainmail vest thing that looks like it's made out of fabric. Like, it didn't look like... It's for show, it seems, but it's meant to look like it's a defense of some sort. Very weird choice.
I mean, as a guy who likes to do knife crime, clearly, I can understand why he would think chainmail would be a good defense against that, but that thing he's wearing doesn't look like it would stop shit. It certainly didn't stop that pipe.
Yeah, nope. like in terms of attitude, like, he's definitely bringing it, but as a physical foil, or as the equal of the fucking hulking mountain of a man that is Arnold in this movie, I'm not sure I'm, like, buying his physical presence exactly. Well,
that's the thing. It's like, whenever he talks about Matrix, it's always like, oh, just wait till I get my hands on Matrix. Right. Just wait till. It's like, there's no acknowledgement that, like, Matrix looks like that. And, you know, Bennett, well, you know, looks like he's probably a capable warrior in his own right. Like, but look at John Matrix.
He's constantly acting. He's like, there's only one man who can stop him, and that's me. It's like, I don't know if you're kind of really.
If that's the case, you're fucked, man.
I'm not sure you guys are really on the same level here. But anyway.
I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that all of John's former unit are now retired and seem like they have been for a little bit. So it's possible that old Vernon had maybe just not been working out as hard as, let's say, our friend John Matrix. That said, I think really what sells the performance for me is not the physicality, but just sort of the weird, unhinged homoeroticism of it. Because while a lot of Schwarzenegger movies are fairly homoerotic as subtext, this just kind of makes it text.
Yeah, there's a horniness to the way that Bennett talks about
Matrix. He wants
Matrix.
To fuck that dude with a knife, I'm telling you right now.
Yeah, at the end when he starts hearing the explosions on the island, he's playing with it. Like, oh, welcome back, John.
Yeah.
Welcome. Yeah.
And the part where he's like, you don't need that gun. You don't need that chicken shit gun. Come on, kill me.
Yeah,
do it.
Basically, he calls him out. I mean, we're skipping to the end here, but he's literally basically saying, like, fucking stick that thing in me and twist it around. I know you want
to. I'm going to stab you in the balls. I'm going to shoot you in the balls.
And the face he makes is the most, like, I just want to fuck face you've ever seen in your life. We'll get more to Bennett in a little bit here. Just a few other cast members to mention here. Dan Hedaya. Doing his best, I'm from South America accent as President Arias of a vague South American country of undetermined origin.
Yeah, I forgot how much that whole side plot and reason for any of this happening is just completely a non-factor. Like, I forgot there's that one thing where it's like, hey, there's this guy that's going to, like, win an election, or we kidnapped your daughter so you can go kill the president. They drop that immediately. Like, that doesn't
none of that
start.
Matters. It matters as much as the stuff that happens in the opening of Predator.
Yes, yes.
This is actually fairly early in Dan Hedaya's career. He was a junior high school teacher for a number of years before he started pursuing acting full time. And originally, Raul Julia was being considered for this part.
Okay. Someone I can see that.
Who actually does have a Spanish accent. but nonetheless, Dan Hedaya got the part because he was friends with one of the producers.
You know, I've never seen the Street Fighter movie.
Really?
You should.
I've never seen a second of it.
Really? It's really it's really bad.
It's really bad.
It seems like my type of bad. It's a video game. I like the
video
game.
It is tremendously campy.
I own it on Blu-ray. I just need to get around to watching it sometime.
You should do it. You should see it sometime. It's a horrible movie. It should not have been Raul Julia's last role, but he does not sandbag it at all.
Oh, he is having so much fun in that movie.
Yeah. James Olsen is General Kirby here. He's just one of those actors that was throughout the 50s and 60s. He did a ton of stuff, and then his career kind of slowed. This was toward the end of his career. He retired in 1990 after doing an episode of Murder, She Wrote, and then lived another decade or two, just living high off that ex-actor high life, I guess.
He's just that Colonel Campbell role in this.
Totally. Yeah, he's just, we need a skinny, kind of weedly military guy to come in here and be surprised every time he finds a bunch of dead bodies. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Duke. Love the Duke. Here is Cook, one of the henchmen. This was his third movie ever. And then the next movie after this was Predator. Talk about
a run. Yeah.
There's a comment Lester makes that, like, Schwarzenegger is incredibly loyal to actors and other people that he likes. A bunch of bodybuilders that he used to hang out with got cast as, like, extras in this movie. I have to imagine at some point he was just like, we need Bill Duke for Predator, and was like, we're getting Bill Duke, goddammit.
Sorry, that's the Green Beret guy that he fights in the hotel, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got it shaving in Predator.
Right.
You know, Arnold liked, Jesse Ventura in Predator, brought him back for Running Man.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, dude, that Arnold just had that sway. Like, he had such a control over his movies, too, that, like, he could, like, make casting decisions, basically.
Totally.
Yeah, yeah. I think I mentioned this when we did actually, Dan, were you on the Predator episode? I can't remember.
I was on Predator 2.
No, you were you not on both?
Was I on the first one? Maybe
I think we were on both of them. Yeah, we did both. Yeah,
that's right.
It was a while ago, to be fair.
We've done a lot of podcasts.
Back to back too. Yeah,
I think I mentioned it then. But if you watch some of the like cast interview behind the scenes stuff on Predator, which is like really good. I mean, they're very entertaining stuff. But like Carl Weathers is on there at one point talking about the like bodybuilding competition that existed between all of them. You know that they would sneak out at 5 a.m. to like try to get to the gym before each other. You know, like that like everybody was trying to look bulked, like bigger than everybody else on the set.
God bless him.
And then our last cast member here. The reason we are doing this, because as we said, we just finished Twin Peaks. We have a number of cast people that we were just watching some movies by folks that were in Twin Peaks. In this case, David Patrick Kelly as Sully.
Yeah, I was all ready to come in here and just kind of laugh it up on this podcast because it turns out he's in this movie for like 30 seconds, but he's got a part.
Yeah, like it's
more than Bill Paxton.
Yeah.
Bill Paxton's got about 30 seconds.
Is Bill Paxton even credited in this? I guess maybe in the...
He is at the very end, but yeah, he's not anywhere near top billing because he had not been in much up to this point.
I mean, David Patrick Kelly's at least like got a memorable role with like several scenes, you know?
Oh yeah. I think as far as like the beginning of the movie is concerned, he's the most important villain.
Mm-hmm. And one of the most memorable deaths, and there's a lot of them.
Yeah. And you know, like at this point he had done The Warriors, which was actually his first movie. This was like his fifth movie. And you know, I think it's a good establishing bit of him. Like, this is a guy who plays a really good creepy henchman. Like, he's just a guy that looks unsettling and can be kind of sleazy and can be kind of fucked up, and exactly the kind of person that Arnold Schwarzenegger should be dangling over a hilltop.
Yeah, especially in this script where he's just like, you know, following Radon Chung through a mall really creepily and like hitting on her and also being kind of menacing and stuff. Like, he was
scumbag.
Perfectly cast for this. Yeah.
David Patrick Kelly, by all accounts, lovely guy, you know, like, plays the mandolin, is a fucking belt holder in, like, karate and tai chi and shit, like, well-rounded, you know, kind of everyman, but plays a really good dirtbag. He's just good at it.
Yeah, you know, like, a lot of actors will talk about how much fun it is to play villains, because they can just kind of cut loose and do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah.
Wrestlers like being heels. Yeah, mm-hmm. Just fun.
Last thing I'll mention here, less the money it made, and more, I was kind of shocked how much this movie actually cost to make. So, the budget, and this includes the overrun, apparently, of, like, a couple of reshoots and other things, was only $9 million.
Jeez.
Interesting. I was taking note of how many expensive-looking cars they fuck up in this movie, and thinking, like, this couldn't have been that cheap.
Well, they fuck up and then unfuck up. If you notice the yellow car that's, like, completely totaled on the side, then he pushes it over and drives away, it's pristine on the side.
Totally fine. Yeah, it's basically, from what I can tell, they saved a lot of money by mostly just building the things they were going to blow up, renting some spaces for the things that they just, you know, like, a lot of the stuff that happens on the island, I think, is in one of the William Randolph Hearst properties somewhere up in San Simeon, and they just rented it and basically were just like, we'll build these structures that we're going to blow up, we won't fuck up the property or anything. And I think because a lot of these actors were still pretty early in their careers, with the exception of Schwarzenegger, I feel like they were able to get most of them for pretty cheap.
Makes sense. Yeah. And also, like, you know, at the end, the big explosion things at the end on the island, they're clearly miniatures. They look good, but they're definitely, like, you can see some just, like, dudes on sticks, like little action figures,
so,
like, slumping over.
Motionless.
Those aren't miniatures. They're dummies. You're right. Those are dummies that are stood up in front of these, like, sheds that they just built and then blew up.
Wait, I always assumed it was miniatures because they were like little dudes on sticks. No. They were normal-sized dudes, normal-sized sheds?
Those are normal-sized sheds. The dummies look especially bad because the sticks they were on didn't really move when they exploded, so they just kind of stand there while everything else explodes.
Yeah, but that's not the kind of shot you get a do-over on, so I guess they roll with it.
Especially not on a $9 million budget, which even in 1985 was not a lot of money.
And then the stuff when there's actual stunt guys, obviously, you can just see the little flip pads so clearly when he's throwing the grenades, just bring the trampoline stuff.
And they certainly did not spend a lot of money on the stuntman wig budget, because holy shit, those guys have the worst fake mustaches and fucking wigs on that I've maybe ever seen in a big action movie. And I say that complimentary. I love how bad they are. But this movie, you know, look, it did very well. It did not explode, but it did make about five times its budget at the box office. And again, helped launch, you know, Schwarzenegger from being a fairly popular action actor to the stratosphere.
What was the next one after this for him?
I think Predator was the next one after this.
My girlfriend and I were going through that last night after she loved this movie, by the way.
Nice.
Oh, that's great.
Also had not seen it. I think it's Predator is next, although the thing, not to get off on like an Arnold tangent, but the thing I was surprised about was his kind of comedy career kicked off a lot earlier than I thought it did.
Mm-hmm. Twins, right? Was that,
like,
the first one?
Twins,
it's not. It's like 3 years after this.
It was like late 80s, right?
If yeah, it's 88.
Mistaken.
One of the few I haven't seen. I've not seen Twins.
So Raw Deal is actually the next one, and then Predator is after that.
And that was with John Belushi, right? James? I always mean Jim Belushi, right?
No, that's Red Heat.
Oh, right. What was Raw Deal was just Arnold.
It's just Arnold and, like, Robert Davi.
Right, okay.
And I don't think Raw Deal is actually very good.
I never got around to that one. That's one
Red
of the,
Heat's
yeah,
okay.
Raw Deal, Twins, Red Heat, those are the ones I haven't really seen.
Red Heat's okay. Raw Deal, I haven't seen it in a long time. I remember it kind of sucking. We're not talking about Raw Deal today. We are talking about Commando. And I think we will actually start talking about Commando after our break. We will be right back. All right, we are back. It's time to open this movie the only way we can on Garbage Day. As we come to learn, we are meeting the former members of one John Matrix's elite unit of doing, killing bad stuff, you guys. And the first one gets smoked in his suburban home by fucking Bill Duke in a fake garbage man uniform.
I was afraid you'd miss me.
Don't worry. You won't.
Now, do we get a sense of, like, you know, because I don't know a lot of military hierarchy stuff, but, you know, later on when he's like, fucking Green Berets, whatever. Like,
eat them for breakfast.
Yeah, so it's like, what, are Green Berets below, like, a SEAL Team 6, and they're below, well, like, whatever this, yeah.
They're different branches, so there is a tremendous amount of inter-branch rivalry in the military.
Oh, yeah, like especially among special forces units.
Yeah, like, but and even generally, just like, you know, Army, Navy, Marines, like, they all kind of talk a bunch of shit about each other, so... I don't know, like, I don't know if Green Berets and SEALs, for example, are actually, like, more or less elite than each other, but it's that there's probably an element of that kind of shit-talking home team kind of stuff.
There should be, like, a reality show where you take all those, like, top-tier military squads from different, you know, disciplines and put them up against each other and
see who wins. Isn't that what American Ninja Warrior is?
Yeah, do that with the U.S. military and see who wins.
No, I think most of those guys are, like, military dudes.
Oh really?
I don't think all of them are, but I think a lot of them are. I've never watched that show.
I have to add it to my DVR.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, in this case, we don't even really know what Matrix's unit is or where it fits in, because the way they talk about it, it is like the top black diamond tier of nobody knows what these guys are doing.
Yeah, like
Foxhound.
Yes, exactly. You kind of assume they've probably like been pulled out of the chain of command entirely, and they're just like operating under the CIA or something at this point.
Yeah,
I feel like it's a good and early indication of how little of an F this movie gives the way this opening sequence is kind of fitted together, because it's like it's like one death, hard cut to another scene with Bill Duke also in it. You know, it's like there's no indication of the passage of time or who these people are or where they are or what the fuck is going on.
He's just running his errands that day. You know,
this guy is just killing a bunch of people with no explanation.
Also, wouldn't more of these guys, if they were the super duper elite, wouldn't they be like a little more prepared for people to come kill them? Like Schwarzenegger was.
We don't know how long they've been retired, though. And the thing is, it seems like most of these guys have kind of, you know, let life get a little softer, you know, because I guess they were given new identities on top of everything else.
Okay. That's why Matrix is the best of the best. You know, he never lost his edge.
Nope. He was ready for this to come back at any point. Unlike this dude who was trying to bring the garbage out and just gets fucking Uzi'd to death in his driveway. Or the guy in the car dealership who's trying to sell, I assume, a Cadillac or something.
Look at the headroom you got in here. A guy like you is not going to have any problem. Go ahead, start it up. Listen to that. That's power. That's performance.
You know what I like best?
What's that?
The price.
Hey! Wait a minute! You can't drive that car!
And just gets run over with his own car, which I'm gonna say, as far as like all the strategies for killing dudes in this, that one feels the most left to chance.
Yes, that one. I'm no like car accident expert or anything, but I was like, is that enough to kill him for sure?
But
didn't he go
over
the top?
Kind of.
He went over the top, and then he kind of ran him down after. I think he kind of rolled over him.
Okay.
It's also all broad daylight. That's like garbage one, the car dealership. It's just the middle of the day or the morning.
Yeah. They don't care. They're operating in plain sight because no one's expecting this, apparently. And then they get to our friend Bennett, who we don't really know anything about except that he's hanging out on a fishing boat like he's Krusty the Clown trying to dodge his taxes. And then he kind of... The reason we know there's maybe something up there is that he gives Bill Duke and the other guy kind of a knowing look before he goes and steers his boat off, and it explodes.
Yeah, just a good close-up of him just kind of looking off into the distance, yeah.
And then we are treated to what I can only describe as the most beautiful opening credit sequence in Arnold Schwarzenegger's entire filmography, because, my God, it is so sickeningly sweet and also so complimentary of his physique and like, inhuman strength.
Like, the long close-ups of his biceps are really...
Yeah.
Like, that's
he's
kinda,
carrying a tree
yes,
and
yeah.
a chainsaw.
He's literally carrying an entire tree. Like, that's kind of what I was getting at earlier. Like, he's been muscly in other movies before, but like this movie glorifies his physique and his and like the action persona. so much more almost to the point of parody, like you said.
Mm-hmm. It's like if you take the close up of the biceps from the handshake in Predator, and you just made it a whole montage of that.
Totally. And they they're teasing out the is someone sneaking up on him, but it's his daughter, and they love each other, and he's a great father, and he takes her out for ice cream, and they're playing, and it's Dan Hedaya's name comes up in the credits, and you're happy, and it's great.
Also produced by Joel Silver, by the way, since we're talking about opening credits.
And this is a fairly early Joel Silver production, I think, in his overall. He's made a lot of action movies over the years. And then it's pretty much off to the races once we get through the credits, because Kirby shows up in the helicopter and he is instantly just like, they're killing your men, John. We need you back.
John, we've got a problem. Someone's killing your men.
You gave them new identities.
There must have been a leak. Lawson, Forrestal, Bennett, they've all been hit.
Who is doing it?
You've made enemies all over the world, John. It could have been the Syrians, the South Americans, the Russians, or a terrorist group. They're going to find you.
We were going to make a normal life here.
You will, I promise. I'm going into the city to coordinate with the federal people. We'll nail those bastards before they get close to you. In the meantime, Jackson and Harris will stay here with you.
Are they any good?
Real good, but not as good as you were.
Yeah, this is the most I know I bring up Metal Gear a lot on everything, but this is the most oh, we got to bring you in for one more movie. It's like, oh no, I'm retired. It's like, but you're the only one that can do this.
And they're coming for you. They're definitely going to come for you next because there's no one left.
Yeah, so going into this movie, I knew nothing, literally nothing about what this movie was other than that it was Schwarzenegger. In fact, I thought it was a Stallone vehicle a couple weeks ago when we first talked about this movie until somebody reminded me. That's how little I knew. But it was fun, in the space between, the colonel showing or the general or whatever he is, showing up to give him the warning and then everything popping off, I had just enough time to wonder, okay, what kind of Schwarzenegger action movie is this going to be? Is he going to get sent out on one last mission? Are they coming for him? What direction is the action going? Is this a holdout in his house? Is this him in a foreign country? Mm-hmm. I didn't even have time to finish that thought. I was oh, there's some build up here. They're building tension that, okay, they're after him. Did not even have time to finish thinking okay, exactly what format is this action going to be before people start getting mowed down? The guy is barely out of frame before people. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. It's literally it's two more cuts from the helicopter flying off to people getting wasted.
Oh yeah. It's immediately when the guys assault the house. And I love in this scene too. It's you can kind of see the budget of this movie. Cause it's this guy's supposed to be this 4-star general or whatever. It looks like they found a green sweater at Goodwill and put a name tag on it.
Oh,
and
definitely.
Got a little cap.
Yeah.
The helicopter looks like a passenger helicopter. They just painted a dark green. Everything just looks a little they skimped a little bit where they could.
I definitely the name tag in particular was it looks like something a fast food employee would be wearing in the '80s.
Yeah, totally.
I will say this is one of the bullet points I got from Vinny. He says, the John Matrix intro is still amazing and perfect. Time from ice cream on face to daughter is kidnapped is just about damn near spot on.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it is. It is maybe 4 minutes from when Kirby is out of the picture to when she is kidnapped and Matrix is fucking cutting loose.
We got time for a breakfast and a Boy George joke. Mm-hmm. So got that.
That's it. And then straight up, it is on and popping. These soldiers are getting mowed down by fucking these random killers. At one point, John Matrix is try to stay downwind from them so they can't smell you. He's like, you can smell them? Yes, John Matrix can smell you from wherever you're coming from.
He's kind of arrogant about it because the guy's like, oh, you want me to smell them? And he goes, I did.
Yeah, I'm better than you, okay? Chuckle fuck. Yeah, they get Jenny. They leave a guy behind to give the proposition of what they want, which is, a mission we'll learn about here in a second. And John Matrix is like, wrong.
Where is she?
Mellow out, man. We can't talk business with you waving guns in people's faces. Your daughter's safe, Colonel. Whether she stays that way is up to you. My people got some business with you. And if you want your kid back, then you gotta cooperate, right?
Wrong.
Yeah, you're gonna play ball with us, right? Wrong. Just
wrong.
Shotgun blast to the head, basically.
That was like this movie kind of telegraphs what it is, you know, over time. And that was, that was probably the first like real moment for me of like, okay, now I know exactly what this movie's vibe is. He did not even try to negotiate with this guy.
No, not important. Also,
I didn't really put this together because I don't think they ever say this in the movie, but I was looking at the IMDb today and Alyssa Milano's name is just Jenny Matrix.
Yeah.
It's a great name.
Matrix is the best dumb last name that has ever been given to an action character, I think.
It really is. I don't know what nationality that is.
It's not anything. It's not a word that it would ever be someone's last name, but that's why it's perfect.
Colonel John Matrix. Again, it sounds like a parody. It sounds like a Simpsons character.
Absolutely. And so from here, he just grabs a truck that doesn't really have a running engine and just fucking hauls that thing down a hill so that he can try and run into one of the vans that is escaping with his daughter.
Which also, a similar thing happens at the beginning of Predator when there's that truck on the outside of the village and he throws the explosives in it and he like picks up the truck and rolls it down the hill. Like, I never put that together. It's like, oh yeah, at the beginning of two of these movies, you're just throwing trucks at people.
Oh yeah, the lesson they learned from Commando is that Arnold Schwarzenegger should always be picking up vehicles whenever possible.
Or phone, phone booths or whatever is on
hand.
Yeah,
whatever you've got on hand.
Yeah.
He doesn't manage to hit the van. It does flip over. He does manage to knock out a few guys before they eventually get him and sort of kidnap him. And Bennett reveals himself. It's like, Bennett, I thought you were dead.
Bennett, I thought you were
dead. You thought wrong. Ever since you had me thrown out of your unit, I've waited to pay you back.
Do you know what today is, Matrix?
Payday.
They trank him, right?
They trank him.
Matrix.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they drag him off to wherever the secret lair of President Arius is, and that's where we get our first real look at Dan Hedaya and his truly excellent accent work as this South American dictator who has been deposed. And what he wants from John is his old job back.
Colonel Matrix, you do not understand a country like Valverde. It is a country that needs a president who has an understanding of discipline.
Why tell me?
Because you're going to return to Valverde and you are going to kill the president that you helped to overthrow me.
Why don't you have Bennett do it? Sounds like something he would get off on.
Because President Velasquez trusts you, Colonel. After all, he made you the hero of the revolution.
Well, Captain Bennett left, shall we say, under a cloud.
Yeah, because he enjoyed killing a little too much.
Your training, Matrix.
You can get close to President Velasquez. You will kill him. You know, Colonel, we went through a lot of trouble to find you. We had to pretend Captain Bennett's death so that General Kirby would become agitated and lead us to you. And now that I have you, you will do exactly as I tell you.
So he was the president of this. Is it a real nation? What is the country, he says?
Valverde?
This is the president of Valvinus. Yes.
Well, it's very telling because the 80s was kind of the height of the, you know, the Contras and all the weird meddling of the CIA and the military and South American and Central American governments.
Manuel Noriega, like it was just like one thing after another.
And I do think
there's also Predator. Predator was kind of like just going to this. Yeah.
And it's going the same well in the same way, which is to say it is using it as very loose set dressing, but it does not care about the actual story happening there. But it is very funny when Kirby is just like, we don't know who's after you. It could be anyone. It could be the South Americans, which is not a country. That's a continent. You're describing an entire continent wanting to kill you. And they might, actually, depending on what he was doing.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. But he wants his old job back. He wants to send Matrix into Valverde, and he wants to send him in to kill the existing president, who it sounds like Matrix at one point maybe helped get that guy into power and get the old guy out of power. Because that was back when the CIA would front and say, no, we're bringing the good leaders into South America. That's definitely what's happening.
Lots of regime change.
Mm-hmm. Definitely always for the better.
This all really happened? This type of stuff?
Some of
it
did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes, wow. 100%.
Go look up the name Augusto Pinochet at some point and learn some really fucked up stuff.
Yeah, look up Allende and what happened when he won the election. And then a number of people thought you should not be in power even though you just won an election.
Don't worry, the CIA is way less effective at it these days. So, you know, he's cornered because they have his daughter. They are very clearly going to kill her if he doesn't do what they want. But John Matrix is not the type to simply sit back and be like, all right, well, I have to go kill this president in order to get my daughter back. He's already formulating a plan. And that plan is fucking ridiculous. But man, does he pull it off.
He's got his watch. He's got his fancy Casio with the countdown timer.
It's a great framing to keep an action movie moving. You know, it's like, hey, you're supposed to be on a long flight. And if I don't hear from your handler, as soon as you land, your daughter's going to die. So it's just like, oh, how long is the flight? Oh, there you go. That's the movie.
It's a great setup. It's dumb. Yeah,
apparently you can
great.
Jump off of that flight at, 500 feet in the air and you're fine.
If you're John Matrix, maybe. I'm not sure anyone else would manage that.
It's like 6 inches of like swamp water.
Yeah. I do always really enjoy a movie that has to find a guy bigger than Arnold Schwarzenegger. Cause I mean, he's not the tallest guy in the world. You know, his hulking presence is a very hard thing to top in any meaningful way, which is why you have to get dudes like Wilt Chamberlain in there to be like, well, that's a guy that actually looks like he might kick Arnold's ass. And they do manage to find a guy in this Henriquez fellow who is going with him on the plane. But also that guy is clearly not equipped for any of this, but because he just jobs him out in a fucking instant.
We're in some real, the get up is very Vice City.
Oh, extremely. Yeah. That's sort of Miami Vice fabulous.
But maybe, I started to say maybe the most audacious moment in the movie when he literally just kills a guy on a plane.
I think that might be number one, just to casually snap his neck. And then it's not like he's put in a position where he has to make a quip. He like stops the flight attendant to be like, hey, listen to this.
Excuse me. How long is the flight?
We land in Valverde in exactly 11 hours.
Thank you. And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
He's don't disturb my friend. In, you know? He's dead tired.
This movie's so fucking stupid.
Yes.
It's awesome.
I mean, the amount of motion he goes through to snap that dude's neck would have at the very least gotten the seats in front of him to turn around and be like, what are you doing to my seat, you know?
Yeah.
But no one cares.
God, puts a little pillow over his face.
Mm-hmm.
That's the magic definitely first class, you know? He's got to let room move around.
That's true. And then, so his plan to get off the plane, because they've already locked the plane, it's starting to move, is to climb down through the landing gear, taking the elevator that I guess the flight crew uses to get down to where, like, you know, the storage for food and baggage and all that stuff is. So he climbs down from the landing gear and is going to go flying off into the water as the plane is taking off.
I couldn't help watching this wondering, like, what were the logistics of pulling this stunt off? Like, can you just rent a commercial airliner for your movie stunt? I guess you can. Like, this is
you
not
can.
I mean, they did it for that Mission Impossible where Tom Cruise hung off the side of
it. That's fair. Yeah, this is not a small plane, you know?
No.
It's like, I wonder what it cost to get this thing for a week.
I don't know what the cost was, but I will say Lester talks about how they did this shot. And what they did was they had a jetliner that would basically, like, take off. It would spin around, then it would come back down again, and they would keep doing different shots from different angles, getting all their coverage where they needed to, and then would basically be in the air for like 5 or 6 minutes, then come back down. As far as Arnold getting off the thing goes, so they tried it a few different ways. It wasn't really working super well, or at least wasn't the dummy wasn't landing or looking quite right the way it was going. So there's one shot in there that is just supposed to be Arnold's body in the air, that is actually animated. Like, they straight up rotoscoped onto the fucking film a shot of a drawn-in Arnold in the middle of that shot as it's coming down.
Yeah, you can
Holy
see it.
Shit.
You can see it if you look at that footage knowing that. It's very framey.
It's like a one-second cut, so you barely notice it, but
it's
there.
Is it where he's falling, like, straight down?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, because I remember thinking that looked really unnatural, because, like, the plane just taken off. You wouldn't just go straight down,
no,
right?
Because the dummy apparently was flying backward a lot when they were trying to get the shot, and that did not look the way they wanted it to. So that was why they ended up going that route. But it seems like Arnold did a lot of stunts on his own. I don't think he did this one on his own. Definitely not
Probably
the swinging
smart.
In the mall, either. But now he is free of his shackles and his airline, and now it is time to go start killing some people. He knows that Sully, who has been taunting him through all this, is still in the airport, so he goes hunting for him, and he happens upon Sully hitting on Cindy, our airline, our stewardess, who is trying to get a date on a payphone, which is maybe the most 1985 thing I can imaginable.
Look at the screens on these payphones, though. It's like futuristic stuff then.
LAX was once a nice airport long ago. Not so much these days. And he accosts her in the parking garage by shoving her into her own little sports car and tearing the chair out so he can fit in.
And then when they drive away, he is like fully just like sitting all the way up. Like
hunched. Oh.
Yeah, well, no, there's a scene when they first pull away and he's like towering above her, like they clearly didn't take the seat out for that shot. There's a lot of that in this movie.
Is that, is that supposed to be the gag that he couldn't fit in there? I thought it was because he was trying to like keep a low profile. And,
I think he's trying to do stealth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a little bit of stealth in there, but I also think that he was not going to fit in that car otherwise. It's a pretty small car.
She is amazingly unperturbed overall at the kind of destruction of her property and so on. You know what I mean? Just like...
Well, and throughout the movie, just her being like okay with this dude that basically just kidnapped her.
Yeah.
I mean, early on, she's pretty upset, but also seems fairly scared and unsure of what to do.
Fair.
We'll give her a couple hours and she'll be shooting bazookas at paddy wagons to save him.
Hey, say nothing. If nothing else, Radon Chong, very game for whatever they ask her to do in this movie. Yes. If nothing else. But yeah, so they follow our friend Sully to one of the gallerias. I forget exactly which one.
Sherman Oaks Galleria. This is the mall from Commando, Terminator 2, and Chopping Mall.
Oh, it's the same one from T2. Wow.
It is the same one from T2.
It is. Yeah, the one where he falls in the mannequin and the T-1000, the Guns N' Roses thing in the back.
Yes.
Like, yep. That's that one.
Okay, it's not that I wasn't on board with this movie or didn't understand what it was doing before this, but this was the scene.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this was the first scene where I was just like belly laughing. Like,
it's
just
hilarious.
dying at the excess.
Fight stuff is amazing, but that one fucking cop he has two lines and they're both amazing. It's want to see me kick some ass to a couple like girls at the mall when he's like looking at Arnold like, I'm going to go kick his ass.
55-year-old dude. Yeah, totally.
Yep. And then he gets on the walkie and he's like, yeah, I got this guy here. He's 6 whatever.
Emergency on a theater level. Suspect, 6'2", brown hair.
He is one gigantic motherfucker. Like, his delivery on that is incredible.
Those are stuntmen, by the way. Those are not actors. The security guard dudes are stuntmen that they gave roles to. That's another way you save money. But so Brad, I just want to briefly mention, this is our second movie in a row that has featured both a stewardess character and a prominent LA mall.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
We did Jackie Brown last week.
Oh, I literally today got a 4K of Jackie Brown in the mail. I just opened it before this.
Wait.
That movie's pretty good.
Is there a 4K of that movie?
It's sitting upstairs. I just opened it.
Holy shit. All right. Well, I need to get
it
on
that. It might
be
new. I don't know.
All right. It must be. But yeah, so they're in the mall. He, over time, starts to kind of plead with her and be like, look, they have my daughter. That's why I'm doing this. That's why I'm stalking this fucking creepy shithead. I need you to go in there and basically help me. Because Sully walks into this random bar or restaurant in the mall. And so she does go in, but then she immediately accosts the security guard and is like, there's a maniac who is chasing me around. Can you go get rid of him? And that is where the security guard stuff happens. And then a bunch of security mall cops basically just start descending on John Matrix. And that goes about how you would expect.
Yeah, Sully at one point's in a phone booth, and Schwarzenegger picks it up and gives a phone booth the attitude adjustment. John Cena's finishing move, like, which is incredible.
That was
a straight up fireman's carry.
Like it's, you know, it's enough that he's like fighting 6 cops, rent-a-cops on a walkway, like this catwalk thing. Like, that's good. But then it's this like 90-second window where he jumps off the side of that walkway, runs up while Kelly's shooting at him through this phone booth, picks the phone booth up and throws it overhead.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's almost that scene too from the second Matrix with all the Agent Smiths that like fly out.
Yes.
He's like, all the cops are kind of swarming him, and he just like, blah, like sends them all flying.
And then seconds after he throws the phone booth, the other guy that Sully was meeting in the bar gets mowed down and flings a briefcase full of cash. it's raining dollar bills in the middle of all this nonsense. Like, it's just so ridiculously over the top.
My favorite line from the commentary from Lester is him talking about this scene, and you can tell, like, this was the era when, like, a lot of filmmakers were watching Chinese and Hong Kong action movies,
sure,
but also were plundering from them regularly. Like, he says, there's a bit where he talks about the guy flying over the rail. He's like, oh yeah, we saw that in one of those Hong Kong action movies, and he doesn't even identify which one because I bet he doesn't even remember.
Sure.
They were just lifting shit, and they were barely paying attention to what they were lifting from.
Yeah, like that's actually a good comparison. Having watched some Hong Kong action on this podcast, like this has a similar madcap quality to some of those action scenes, but it's like way stupider or less. Like it's
there's less elegance to
yes,
all of it.
That's what
well,
it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, like Police Story with Jackie Chan. Like at the end, it's like in a mall, and he's like there's all these like set piece type things where you're sliding down a chain of lights and all that from one story to another. And it is done. I think elegance is the word. Yeah.
This is kind of like that's exactly it. This is like kind of the meat-headed American version of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Their thing is
which,
ballet.
Both are awesome.
Ours is square dance.
Yes. Sure.
Yep. Yep.
So once he throws the phone booth and does his Cirque du Soleil routine, which that is the other stuntman, and apparently that stuntman was like 5'2", and they're like, this dude is not going to look like Arnold. And he's like, when I'm swinging through the air, you will absolutely not know how big I am. And you know what? It doesn't look like Arnold, but he's right. The size difference does not come across at all.
Yeah, it's a wide shot.
Yeah, it's a wide shot, so you can't tell. And he lands on that fucking elevator and then just fucking runs Sully down and chases him out of the parking lot with Cindy. And that's when we get to it's nighttime now, and suddenly we're up here in the fucking Hollywood Hills chasing his ass down. And Sully ain't gonna make it out of this.
Now, Sully is before the Green Beret fight, right?
Yes.
That is
that's
before
right,
the, that
gives
is the one
the
right
location
before.
Of the, yeah, he gives the location of the hotel when he's
yeah, because
peril.
He has the
that's
key
right.
in his pocket, so that's how Matrix that's right. knows that he's supposed to go there.
He just goes through a succession of nice cars as people die here.
Yeah. He gives him the location, and then Schwarzenegger thanks him and lets him go home.
This is my weak arm.
Ah, you can't kill me, Matrix. You need me to find your daughter.
Where is she?
I don't know. But cook those. I'll take you where I'm supposed to meet her.
But you won't.
Why not?
Because I already know. You remember, Sally, when I promised to kill you last?
That's right, Matrix. You did.
I lied.
What'd you do with Sally?
I let him go.
That is one of the shots where it's like you can just clearly see there is like the fishing line type thing hanging off of Sully's foot as he's dangling.
Oh, yeah, it's super obvious, but also there's no way Arnold would ever be able to hold a guy like that, so
no,
you have to
Arnold.
Do it that way.
Yep.
And, you know, he kills him, he drops him down the fucking hillside, he dies pretty good, and then he just flips that fucking car over, and he's like, well, now we have a ride, let's go.
Yeah, so you don't have a car, how are we going to get there? Now I do.
And, you know, this is where you get a little bit of the flavor text, like Cindy is kind of asking him questions about the work he does, and kind of, you know, Jenny and all that stuff. None of it matters. You know exactly what the story is because you've seen it 1,000 times, but it's just like, I did bad jobs. Now I don't do those anymore. I am father.
I'm sorry I got involved in this.
Well, why don't you tell me what this is all about?
It's about her.
Is this your daughter?
You know, some people are using her to force me to do a job. If I don't get to her soon, they'll kill her.
Well, did you do the job?
No. I knew they would kill her even if I did it. My only chance now is that I get to her before they find out what I'm doing.
Well, what about her mother?
She died when Jenny was born.
I'm sorry.
I was in Laos at the time. So I came back intending to raise her. But I was never home. When she was 3, I was in Lebanon. When she was in grammar school, I was in Angola. When she had the measles, I was in Pakistan. And now she's been kidnapped because of me.
Well, why did you have to do all that traveling?
Special assignments.
Is that for the army or something?
Or something.
Oh. What did you have to do?
Things you don't want to know about. Things that sometimes I wish I didn't know about. But that part of my life is over with. All that matters to me now is Jenny.
Yeah, well,
that's
you know.
All of that's cut for the theatrical. Like, I think this was the first time I had seen that scene.
This is like maybe the most character development that happens in the entire movie, you know, is that like, not only did he do a lot of bad shit, but he was an absentee father.
Yeah.
To do it.
For a while there, yeah. And so once he's back, he's just like, I am a father now. That is all I do. And, you know, I think that Cindy at this point is probably convinced, at least sufficiently. Whether or not this flight attendant really should be your cohort on this extremely murder-filled adventure. I don't know, but I feel like, you know, as paper-thin as these kinds of characters tend to be in these movies, at least Raydon Chong is having some fun with it.
Yeah, I think she's fine in this movie. It's kind of weird they, like, walk right up to her becoming a love interest here and then never really actually get there by the end of the movie.
They kind of allude to it, but that's it.
Yeah, but not...
Yeah, there's no, like, kiss or anything like that. No.
No, she just sails off into the sunset with them, and you can assume, well, they got married and lived happily ever after. Whatever, you know? I guess the original script was more explicit about the romance, and they just like, hey, we don't need any of that.
Yeah.
Leave the audience wanting. There is this brief bit in here. So they go to the hotel. They get to Sully's room, and then Cook eventually shows up as they are looking for evidence of things. And they have their little, pissing contest about who's stronger, and Arnold handily wins that.
I love this hotel room so much.
Oh, the glass squares and everything. The
glass square walls with the green and red lights. This is the most 80s looking thing in this entire movie.
Hell yeah.
80s by way of 1950s, you know, it's like that kind of like, you know, slightly retro neon thing, but then given a current 80s sheen. You know, I'd say Cook puts up an okay fight in the brief bit here. There is also this completely unnecessary scene where they crash into two people fucking in another room, but I also appreciate that it's unnecessary and they did it anyway.
It's a confounding position happening there too. Yeah.
Well, you know, look, sexuality is a fascinating and diverse place.
Well, of course. Note they have a camera set up in there.
Yeah.
Oh, did they?
Yes.
They might be making some specialty films. Who can say?
I see. Yes.
Cook is not going to be a part of any of those because that dude just gets stabbed through the motherfucking chest.
Yep. What did he land on again? Was it part of the
table
divider
leg or something?
It's got to be like a broken chair leg or something. They really don't go out of the way to explain it.
But he dies way before he gets the chance to tell them anything. But they do find at least some reference in something to some warehouse somewhere. So that's where they're going next.
It's all very vague. It's like, okay, there's kind of a warehouse somewhere. And it's like, here's a picture of a plane. And, oh, there's a map. Okay, here's what's going on. Like,
Arius seems to have some tie to this warehouse, so let's just go there and hope something that tells us where to go next is.
Oh, the bare minimum to get from, you know, this scene to the next scene.
Yeah, like in the middle of all this, they've also, like, the villain has also relocated with Jenny, and it's never really made exactly clear where that is. I mean, later we find out it's just on, like, some private island or something.
Yeah, like 2 hours off the coast of L.A.
Right, like, but at the time, you know, at first it's like, wait, are they going to the country he's trying to take over? Like, what is happening here? Like, it's also, like, the movie does not care, is the point.
No,
like,
it is not invested in trying to communicate what any of the, like, where any of this stuff really is for the most part.
We just need to move the bad guys to this big, expansive villa so that we have more room for a shoot-em-up later.
Also, I don't think we pointed out, during every single thing we've described here from this movie, there's just steel drums playing in the background.
God, that was like the first thought I had watching this last night. I was like, I have to remember to bring up the steel drums. Like, what the fuck? Also,
this is the entire soundtrack.
James Horner Titanic fame soundtrack for this movie, or the score.
So the steel drums are definitely a point of either contention or debate, depending on how you want to put it, around this soundtrack. I think it's amazing for what it is.
Yes.
He does reuse some of the motifs he used in 48 Hours and some of his earlier scores in this, but I don't think they had the prominence of steel drums that this one does. And it is definitely one of James Horner's most notable scores, shall we say.
It gives it a unique flavor, I'll say that.
Once they go to this warehouse scene is maybe the most unnecessary step in this entire process, because all he really does is kind of stealth in there, kill a guy, and then get out of there with a little bit of evidence. And that's kind of it.
I mean, it does give you this shot of him literally just ripping this corrugated panel off the side of the building to get in. It's kind of hilarious.
It almost feels like it's like padding to make it hit 90 minutes. Like, it's like
pretty
it's
much
pretty unnecessary.
I will say the actor that he does kill in this movie is a character actor of some note, Branscombe Richmond. He's the other guy in the Lorenzo Lamas series Renegade.
Oh, wow.
He's like the sidekick character in that show.
Wow.
No one else cares about that besides me because I watched a weirdly high amount of Renegade, which is more than one episode. But yeah, I remember him from that, and he just dies in about 2 seconds in this. And what they find, I guess, basically, is that there's a plane somewhere in San Pedro It's a seaplane. It's an old one. There's fuel there. They can go to the island using that plane. So they're going to do that, but first they have to go shopping.
This is another one of the scenes that I was just fucking losing it during.
Yeah. The thing I can't tell is if he knew that secret panel would be back there full of secret guns, or if he just guessed.
You would think that guy has been to that store before.
Probably.
Yeah, he's probably at least eyeballed it.
There's kind of a supermarket sweep quality to this whole sequence,
yes.
You know,
where it's
just like, I'm going to grab this knife, I'm going to get these flippers, because why not? Brad. Here's some binoculars, just like a vest.
Brad, you're thinking exactly the way I thought, and not to bring up an old project I did, but Air Force Gator 2, I wrote a scene where him and President Obama break into a military surplus store because Air Force Gator is about to go to an island and kill a bunch of people.
Great.
And he says to Obama, as he's putting a bunch of guns in a bag, he says, "It's like I'm on supermarket sweep and I'm just filling my cart up with turkeys." So we're thinking the same there.
Danny, you need to get back to writing books.
I have considered it.
Just the escalation of the scene, though, once he gets into that, like, kind of weapons compartment, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Bigger and bigger machine guns, and then the fucking rocket launcher.
Yes.
And this was, like, maybe the first point where I thought, like, okay, maybe this movie is self-aware, because he does get caught here, you know? Like, I was the whole time, I was just like, okay, I know this movie doesn't give a shit about believability, but boy, is he really just acting recklessly with no consequences. But then the cops show up, so I was like,
he drives
right.
a bulldozer through the wall of a surplus store, like, near L.A.?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, so this is a real, by the way, this is a real Army Navy surplus store. They redid the front of the building to do this shot, basically, and had to like buy out the owner for the night or whatever to be like, hey, we're gonna shoot here. But yeah, like the whole thing. I honestly think his plan, if he got caught, was just to Kool-Aid man his way through a fucking prison wall. Like, I don't think he ever even if I get stopped for 5 seconds, I'm just going to fucking bust out of wherever it is I'm going. Though in this case, he doesn't have to, because Radon Chong read the instructions and figured out how to work that rocket launcher.
She says she read the instructions, but if she did, it definitely was not on screen, and I don't know when she had the time to.
It's such a great gag when she shoots it backwards first.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Oops. I will say there was apparently an alternate version of that line where she says, "I learned about it in high school." I learned how to shoot one of those in high school, which is very confusing, but I would have accepted it at the same level of I read the instructions.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, after firing it backwards one time, she spins it around and manages to knock this police paddy wagon off its axis and spring our friend John. And then, yeah, it's on at that point. You know, like Kirby shows up every once in a while, usually one or two scenes behind whatever murders just took place. Constantly referencing World War III is coming, there will be more bodies, he knows what's coming. And then Jenny starts plotting her escape as they are getting ready to head out.
I love, this is like, just going back to the World War III thing, like I love how there is absolutely zero justification for that comment. Like we're talking about like one probably relatively small inconsequential nation with maybe a power struggle going on. There's like zero indication of like, are they backed by the Soviet Union or something? Like, what is going to start World War III here?
I don't think that's what he's talking about. I think what he's saying is specifically the amount of carnage that is about to come in John Matrix's wake is World War III.
Okay.
I think the same way that Arnold, when he's getting into the little kayak, tells her that, like, all fucking hell is about to break loose.
Yeah.
Sure.
Like, basically, he is himself a human nuke. They just drop into things when they need everything to die. And so, you know, she's starting to formulate her plan out of this palatial estate, and then they get to the plane, and there's this really dumb shootout that happens at the plane. This is the most awkward, goofy thing I feel like that happens in any of this.
Incredibly
it's
dumb.
Arnold with a Uzi that he's shooting like one-handed from 200 feet away at a Jeep on a dock and manages to hit both guys. It's very awkward.
I mean, there's a lot of missed shots from everyone involved until there's it's time for them not to miss, you know?
Yes.
I don't know who this guy that he fucking kills at the beginning of this scene is. He looks like he's almost 70.
Yes.
Like he's like some old Western actor that just happened to wander into frame for a second and he just
Lee
fucking
Van
kills
Cleef
him.
Lee Van Cleef was on the set visiting for one day and they put him in.
It's a real motley crew that Arius has going here. And she's freaking out because this plane, she's learning how to be a pilot, but she has never flown something like this, which does appear to be a little bit of a bucket with wings.
Yeah, she says she had been in, like, pilot school or something, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the one thing they drop, is that, like, I know this is, like, seaplane fuel because I'm learning how to be a pilot, and that's where my my instructor gets his fuel from. So that's why I'm in this plot.
And there's still a moment where she's, like, taking off, and they're trying to clear something in the water, and, like, Arnold knows enough to, like, reach up and pull some lever on the top. It's like, okay, I guess he knows that.
Yeah. I get the impression Matrix has probably been trained in just about every kind of mechanical device he would ever need to escape a situation where he just killed a bunch of people.
Yeah, it comes from the Matrix. It just downloaded it all. Yeah.
And this is kind of where you get this interstitial bit. The only real flavor text you get with Bennett that does not involve John Matrix directly is him talking to Arius about his shitbag soldiers. And that one guy is just like, I cut the girl's neck. It goes through like butter, whatever the fuck he says. And he's just like, get the fuck out of here, you fucking piece of shit. You're just some dumb scumbag criminal they roped into this. I'm a real soldier. And, you know, he tries to kind of chides Arius about it. He's like, these are men are patriots. These men, you know, they are whatever. And it's like, yeah, they ain't gonna fucking hold goddamn shit against John Matrix.
I love listening to your little pissant soldiers trying to talk tough. They make me laugh. If Matrix was here, he'd laugh too.
Mr. Bennett, my soldiers are patriots.
Your soldiers are nothing. Matrix and I could kill every one of them in a blink of an eye. Remember that.
Are you trying to frighten me?
I don't have to try. When Matrix finishes the job, he'll be back for his daughter. Now, whether she's alive or dead, doesn't matter. Then he'll be after you. Now, the only thing between Matrix and you is me.
It is you that is afraid, Mr. Bennett. You are afraid of Matrix.
Of course, I'm smart. But I have an edge. I have his daughter.
It is incredible, because the setup here is like, what are there, 100 dudes on this island?
Maybe 150 at most, yeah.
And one guy. It is maybe the most egregious, you know, for something that's not a Hot Shots type parody, it is, I think, the most egregious one man versus an army scene I've maybe ever seen.
Oh, it is, when I call this movie unhinged, it's really this scene. I mean, like, yeah. all of it is pretty ridiculous, but this is like, you know, any one of these deaths is not very interesting on its own, you know, but when you start stacking them for as long as it does, like, it starts veering back into hilarious.
And the speed in which they happen, just one after another after another. And it's preceded by the suit up sequence.
That was the moment where I was like, all right, this movie knows what it's doing. Like,
yes.
That also, like, well, he's getting dressed. I had to laugh when he gets off of the plane in his underwear.
Yeah,
because it's just like, ah, look, we have a Mr. Universe in our movie. We need to, like, show him off a little bit.
Very tasteful Speedo shot.
Shot of him, like, you know, kind of canoeing up or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, Jesus Christ. And then that suit-up sequence, it looks like, you know, before you put your coin in on, like, a, you know, early 90s Contra-like
like Operation
arcade.
Wolf, like, title screen type shit. Yeah.
So, yes. when I talk about, like, yes, like, arcade side cabinet art, NES covers, like, all that stuff, it's like this shot of him with the, like, the face paint, like, lines across his face, mm-hmm. Like the vests, bandolier looking shit with like grenades and shotgun shells. You know what I mean?
That putting is such a guns, putting grenades on belt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like that is such a familiar, like that is the prototypical image of Arnold Schwarzenegger as an action hero that I think of from the '80s. And again, I've never even seen this movie, you know, like that's how pervasive this particular stereotype is.
And especially,
I mean,
look at
the
games.
Cover art. Look at the, the old one where it's like him with two grenades, just black background, eye black, you know, camo vest and everything, giant biceps. Like, yeah, that is Arnold.
Let's party.
Yeah.
And this last sequence, from the moment he gets off that canoe with wings and in the Speedo, it is basically about 20 to 25 minutes of the rest of the movie is this entire action sequence, and then maybe 90 seconds of the kind of, you know, the outro, basically. Because the only thing you see here before he really starts fucking going ham is the shot of the plane landing in Valverde and Arius's scumbags fucking, you know, walking up and be like, where's the guy? Where's what's happening? And then a body gets loaded out, and it's Henriquez, the dude that has been dead for like 12 hours. And they immediately call and send the signal, but before they can do anything, it pops off.
When I was in college, a regular thing we did, sometimes several times a week, was we would get back from the bar after last call, we would keep drinking in the dorms, and we would queue it up on the DVD chapter select to this exact moment.
Yeah.
And many times we would try to tally how many guys died. And like, you know, we would have rules where it's like, okay, only on screen, we can assume somebody was in that lighthouse, somebody was in that shed or whatever. But even just counting like visible deaths, I want to say it was like in the 80s that we could tally every time.
I need to actually see if there is a commando body count. I need to know.
Oh, God. I wonder if the body count in that scene in Hot Shots is true when they're like going for the record of how many kills and it's showing like Rambo Part 2, this, RoboCop.
Okay. According to the internet, which you can't trust anymore, the final island scene has 74 kills.
Okay. Okay.
I believe it.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
And Jesus. It sounds like about 81 people total in the movie. So the vast majority come in this sequence.
I'm sorry. I thought you meant there was like 81 people in the movie. No. Well, 74 of them died.
Honestly, that is probably pretty close to the number of actual actors in this movie, and almost all of them die by his hand. Because some of those stuntmen were almost assuredly showing up in the next sequence, like the next cut with just a different mustache on or something. But yeah, look, breaking down this action sequence is difficult because it is just an endless parade of dudes getting riddled with bullets, dudes exploding, guys going flying, buildings exploding with dummies not really going flying when they're supposed to, but it doesn't matter because everything blows up real good. What do you want to talk about? What do you want to say?
Can I add on to the kill count a little bit here?
Mm-hmm.
I found a ranking. I'm doing a little more data science over here.
Please do.
I found a ranking. I think this might be the same thing you were looking at, Alex, but this guy has collated a bunch of data on like all of the top action movie stars in history.
Mm-hmm.
25 deadliest actors by on-screen kills. Of course, Schwarzenegger is in the lead by a lot.
Okay. I would have believed that Stallone was very close behind.
Stallone is third after Chow Yun-Fat.
Okay.
Okay.
But the thing I was going to point out is this puts him at 369 kills as of 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So fully like a fifth of his on-screen kills ever almost are in this fucking one scene.
Yeah. Of his legendary action
in his entire career. if this data is to be believed.
And I'm not going to stand here and call this the best choreographed or the most tightly exciting action scene ever made or anything like that, but it's so ridiculous. So stupid.
That's what it is.
You have to embrace it.
That's what it is. Yeah, because, you know, like 80% of these kills are him just running with a machine gun. You know?
Yes. Sometimes not even pointing at the guy who is then immediately throwing his hands up and going, "Aah!"
Right.
Dying.
Not even taking cover. He's like standing in a field and there's six dudes on a rooftop with direct line of sight to him. And he's just like, right. Just killing all of them.
Like occasionally, you know, like that little gardening shed sequence, you know, you do get some interesting stuff with like throwing the little saw blades and stuff. Like there is some inventiveness in a few of these kills, but really, really, this is just like such a monument to excess and spectacle.
Totally. Yeah. And what a spectacle it is, because as you said, lots of people die. Every time they die, it somehow looks stupider because the stuntmen just start getting even crazier and sloppier with their fucking flying and diving everywhere. Like, a lot of the time, like you said, he's running through an open field, just firing all willy-nilly, and dudes just are going, and fall down. But it's great. And I will say the one bit that is a little bit more fun and has a little more ingenuity going on is when he gets stuck in this shed and he starts using gardening tools to maim and kill people.
Start with the rake, because he's doing the, like, Spider-Man up above the door thing. He mm-hmm. rakes down into a guy's chest. He throws, I think, two jigsaws into dudes.
Yep.
He chops an arm off. He axes a dude in the nards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good stuff here. And it's all in, like, 10 seconds.
Yeah, it's very short. The guy whose arm he cuts off is the one who was talking about slitting the throats of little girls at one point, so this is justified.
I missed that. He really sells the screaming as his arm's cut off.
Oh, yeah. I heard in the script, the plan was that the guy would be screaming, and then I think Arnold would say, like, "Shut up," and then hit him in the head with his own arm or something like that.
That was not in the script. That was something Arnold wanted to do, apparently.
Oh, awesome.
He came up with that idea, and he wanted to slap the guy with his own arm, which Mark Lester said, that might actually be a step too ridiculous for what we're doing here.
Should have listened to Arnold.
And the guy who gets the axe in the crotch maybe has the worst fake mustache of anyone in this entire movie.
Yeah.
And that's saying a lot because there are a lot of bad wigs and mustaches.
Yes.
And then he has to square off against Arius, and this is not much of a fight for obvious reasons, because this is an elderly, you know, fucking totalitarian dictator who just has a machine gun, and he is no match for the force that is John Matrix.
He just kind of gets shot four times in the chest with a shotgun.
Pretty much. He does kind of walk down the hall with that gun looking pretty determined. I'll give him that. Dan Hedaya does sell it as best as you can for this character, but there's never a moment where you even think, I mean, they frame him like he's the big bad in this movie, but I think by this point everyone knows he's just a weird pawn in this whole thing. Bennett's the big bad.
Yeah, Bennett's the one that's going to give him a bunch of trouble.
Mm-hmm. And he does, kind of, a little bit.
More than others. Yeah.
Yeah, eventually. Jenny does escape, and Bennett does spend a lot of this fight chasing her around in a boiler room. Eventually does catch up with her, and then they have their face off. And it is very much, I'm going to kill you, John. I'm going to kill you. Oh, I'm going to kill you. And that's pretty much it. It's a lot of, like, John just taunting him, being like, you don't need this gun. Let's knife fight. And then they knife fight.
Come on, Bennett. Throw away that chicken shit gun. I just want to pull a trigger, to put a knife in me, and look me in the eye, and see what's going on in there when you turn it. Right?
I'll kill you, John.
Come on, let the girl go. It's between you and me. Don't deprive yourself of some pleasure. Come on, Bennett. Let's party.
I can beat you. I don't need the girl. I don't need the girl!
I don't need the gun, John. I can beat you.
I don't need no gun! I'm gonna kill you now!
And it's just Vernon Wells making the horniest faces you've ever seen while someone is having a knife fight.
He really...
Very sweaty. Yeah, they're in like a steam... Not a steam room, but like a furnace
area. Might as well be a steam room.
Yeah, yeah. It's just one of those areas that so many action movies in the 80s ended in. Just random, just hooks and chains and belching
industrial
flames.
Industrial gear and whatever, yeah.
Yep, yep.
And look, one of the things Vinny told me was Vernon Wells, and by virtue Bennett, maybe one of the least intimidating villains he's ever seen in a movie. And I'm going to say, yes, I sort of agree. He's not physically imposing, but there is this weird, unhinged, creepy quality that I think does sell it a little bit.
That's kind of what I was saying earlier with his attitude. Like, there is definitely a manic quality to his performance here that kind of makes up for like the lack of an imposing image.
I mean, and it makes it more memorable than like if they had just gotten another like a William Forsythe or someone from the era, you know, like sure they would have done a fine job, but like you remember Bennett.
Yeah, because there is that unhinged quality. And again, that's very much his road warrior persona. So I can understand why they went to him for it. Again, his outfit makes no fucking sense. He is not defended in any way with that chainmail, but you remember the chainmail. That is the thing you remember about that character. That, and I'm going to kill you, John. I'm going to kill you. And that's pretty much it.
Pipe through the chest.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way he goes out is the other thing you remember. Because
let off some steam, Bennett.
Is maybe, I'm going to say, top three all-time Arnold one-liners.
I would also say Dead Tired is like a potential, yeah, Mount Rushmore.
That's in the running for sure.
Yeah, we got a couple real good ones in this. I mean, I Lied is good. There's a lot of good ones here.
I'm trying to think, like, was this movie kind of the beginning of the kill and one-liner pairing?
Like, I mean, he does I'll Be Back. Well, that's not a kill one, but I'll Be Back was Terminator, and then he does it again in this.
Yeah.
But yeah, the kill and then the one-liner. He does a little bit of it in, like, Predator later when he does, like, stick around.
And, like, total, you know, like, See You With Party Richter and stuff. Like, definitely more of a thing later. And, you know, like, Terminator, he's the villain, you know. Here it is, like, specifically the protagonist just kind of gleefully knocking people off and cracking wise about it kind of thing.
This feels to me, whether it is actually the case or not, this feels to me like Arnold getting more carte blanche to kind of do whatever he wants. Because Mark Lester, look, I'm going to be real, not a particularly storied or vaunted career for him. Not a director that anyone was, like, super familiar with back at this point. Did not have a ton of, like, big movies under his belt. I think he was just kind of stoked to have Schwarzenegger there and just kind of let him do what he wanted to do. I mean, some of those lines were probably in the script, but I imagine the way he hams it up is very much like Arnold getting to stretch his legs probably for the first time in a big starring thing like this.
Sure, sure. I don't think we mentioned, speaking of one-liners, like they drop I'll Be Back and Trust Me both in this movie from Terminator, which kind of felt like weirdly out of place. You know, it's like, oh wait, that's another movie's catchphrases.
Arnold loves to remember things he was in.
Yeah, I'll Be Back. Yeah, I'm always surprised when I watch an old Schwarzenegger movie because, like, he brings it up in a lot of non-Terminator movies.
Does he? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, this and there's at least a couple more I want
to
say.
Arnold's approach to his persona and his lines of dialogue that people remember is very pro wrestling. Like, sure. his notion is hit the fucking one-liners, hit the things that the marks want, and he will do it every as often as it makes sense for him to do it.
Clearly, he knows how to build a brand.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. He does in Commando, Raw Deal, The Running Man, Last Action Hero, Twins, Kindergarten Cop, and The Sixth
Jeez.
Day.
Yeah.
All right.
And at least a couple of those are very directly him just like parodying himself more than anything else.
Yeah, he said the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You said the line. Everyone's happy. Let off some steam, Bennett. It's a good death, I will say. It's super dumb, but it is the only way this extremely weird, awkward, badly choreographed knife fight between them could have ended in a way that was super memorable. Like, they just go for the thing you don't expect, which is him tossing a pipe through a man's torso into a steam pot or what, or fucking vent or whatever, and the steam shooting out of the dead guy.
Through the sternum, through the heart, the rib cage, out the back, through the spine, I guess. Like,
that
God
probably
damn,
doesn't feel good.
Hard.
I bet that feels real bad. Don't matter, because he's dead. Everyone's dead. The whole fucking island is dead. And true. By the time the military gets there, did we leave anything for them?
Just bodies.
Hit the music. Yeah.
That.
God damn.
That song apparently is performed by one of the members of Duran Duran with the band Power Station.
Okay.
Jeez.
And I think
is the last line Kirby being like, hey, can I ever convince you to come back? And he's like, no chance.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And it's the way Kirby says it is super awkward too. He's just like, he starts a different conversation after asking the bodies thing. He was just like, leave anything for us? He's like,
I'd just like you to start off your unit again, John. All it would take is you're coming back.
This was the last time.
Until the next time.
Chance.
It's like he starts in the middle of another conversation, like, we just want you to come back, John. We just want you to start your unit up again, which, by the way, he has not even really said to him at any point in this movie of, like, we want you to come back.
No, we want you to do this one specific thing.
Yeah, like, the whole, like, we need you to start your unit up again thing feels very much like we just need a reason for Arnold to turn to the camera and mug for a second.
Yep.
So they do it, and that's where you get the, no chance.
Fly away credits.
Guitar riff.
Fuck yes. Incredible.
It is.
It's an economical movie. It doesn't waste a lot of time.
Yeah. No. Maybe the tightest 91 minutes anyone has ever filmed.
It's that in Rocky IV. I put them on the same level.
Now, Brad, we've gotten through it. Give me your final thoughts. How do you feel having seen this for the first time, you know, so late in life and just in general?
I finally feel complete for the first time in my life.
Amazing.
Like, I mean, like I said, though, I mean, it literally is like filling in a gap in what should have probably been some cultural education about 40 years ago, almost.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It fills in a lot of blanks, I feel like, that just, you know, again, there's so many references, so many things in pop culture that have just called back to this movie in various ways. And the movie itself, again, fairly dumb, but still very enjoyable no matter what. Like, it'll be all these years later.
It's incredibly watchable, and it's one that is very good to just kind of, when you hear that a friend hasn't seen it, be like, all right, we're going to watch this right now, and it's pretty much always a crowd pleaser. I can't imagine watching this movie and not having some sort of feeling or opinion on it. Like, if you think it's dumb as shit, it's like remarkably dumb as shit.
Totally.
I'm immediately seized by a need to know what Roger Ebert thought of this movie.
I know Gene Siskel.
Yeah.
Yeah, Siskel didn't love it. I know that.
I don't know if he wrote a review of this or not, now that I look around for it. I don't think he did, sadly.
No, I'm not sure that Ebert ever did. I'm sure they covered it on their show, though. There's probably a video out there of them talking about it. Siskel gave it like 2 out of 4 or something in the Tribune. So,
I mean, critics didn't like fucking Predator. Imagine what they thought of this.
Yeah, I have to imagine this movie probably did not review super well, but it was very successful and was a huge factor in turning Arnold Schwarzenegger into the Schwarzenegger that we know. Without Commando, do we have Governor Schwarzenegger? Maybe not.
Do we get T2?
Maybe not. It's all Commando's fault.
Thanks, Commando.
Thanks, Commando.
We got Chris Pratt now.
We sure do.
Yep.
Well, we don't have Chris Pratt coming up on the Watchcast anytime soon, thankfully. Now, last thing I'm going to mention here on the Commando front before we start talking about what we're going to do when we come back, I do have Vinny's ranking if you want to know where it goes.
Sure.
He did also want me to mention that the last 15 minutes of the movie are straight up immaculate. So,
yes,
he's on board with us. This movie fits onto his list, and again, you have to be keeping track of where this list is. But he says it's at number 40 on his list, right under Righting Wrongs, but above Trespass.
Okay.
What?
All right. That seems respectable.
See this fucking list.
Vinny's list is really interesting, and I will say that most of the movies I think that we have watched he has enjoyed. The bottom rung is really only about 10 or 12 movies, so...
Okay.
But Dan, most of these movies he has some fond feelings about.
I've sent you a link if you have access to your Discord at the moment.
Oh, yes, let me see.
Oh, is that his letterbox list?
Yes.
And this is everything he's watched on the Watchcast?
This is everything we have watched on the Watchcast, yeah.
Okay, The Thing, Jaws, Das Boot, haven't seen that. Wow, really liked Everything Everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, a lot of good stuff. Bram Stoker, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I think that's a good movie. Haven't seen Blue Velvet, Mission Impossible. Wow, you've watched some good stuff here.
I think for reference, Predator is at 18, if we want to talk about other Arnold movies of the era.
Mm-hmm.
He's so. Putting some stuff. Wow, Johnny Mnemonic above Commando. Dick Tracy, the Warren Beatty one, above Commando. Okay. All right, but most of these are pretty good, I would say, at least.
Yeah, the thing is, I think Vinny finds things to like about some of these movies, even if they're... I mean, look, he doesn't think Dick Tracy is an amazing movie, but there's some stuff he likes about it, so...
Sure.
And I think in this case, there's some stuff he likes about Commando. Maybe not everything.
You watched The Phantom for this?
Yeah,
sure
we were doing some weird 90s hero stuff that was, like, not straight up, like... you know, comic book necessarily, like not Marvel or anything, and that was one of those.
Yeah, I think we needed to see the good and the bad of 90s hero cinema.
And we sure. wanted more Billy Zane also after doing the Twin Peaks stuff, so.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's been
incredible.
It's been a hell of a ride, and we are going to be writing, I think, this wave of ex-cast members of Twin Peaks for a little bit longer. For probably at least a few more episodes before we get into September's new theme. Now, as we said, we are not going to be posting an episode next week because we are all out on break. But when we come back, we are going to be posting a new film, and that one will be a film featuring the star of Twin Peaks, Kyle MacLachlan. It is a 1987 science fiction movie called The Hidden. It is the first movie he ever starred in that was not directed by David Lynch. And it is great. It is not a movie a lot of people have seen, but I think it is actually kind of awesome.
I'd never heard of it before.
Me either.
Yeah.
Didn't I see, in fact, didn't this factor into the decision-making? Didn't Kojima proclaim this to be his favorite movie?
Yes, he did.
Well, I think now it's Deadpool and Wolverine, right?
It might be. I don't know. But... he did just tweet very recently about saying, I just rewatched my favorite movie, The Hidden. And so that was my moment of like, okay, well, I was thinking about Showgirls, but actually we should probably do this.
Oh, Showgirls is incredible.
I really wanted to watch Showgirls.
We will do Showgirls because the Verhoeven month is probably imminent at some point, and we will do that.
It is so much crazier than you think it is.
Yeah. It rules. And I think The Hidden is also pretty fucking crazy and also rules, just in a very different way. So that will be our movie when we come back. But for now, as I said, there will be a 1 week break before we come back. And then a couple more Twin Peaks folk movies and then a new theme. We will announce all that stuff on the Patreon when we get there. Dan Reichert, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Of course. Anytime. It's always a pleasure.
Talking about one of your favorite movies, I know. Always a good time.
Oh, yeah.
But hey, you know, we needed an expert here, and I appreciate that.
Any excuse to watch and talk about Commando, I will happily take.
Fantastic. And Brad Shoemaker, thank you as always.
Thank you. Consider me entertained.
Hell yeah. And thank you to everyone who's been listening and watching along at home with us. We'll see you next time.